Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I was going to start off with the usual. You know, such a beautiful day. What is everyone doing here inside? But it's beginning to be ho-hum, another beautiful day in paradise. I don't know how many days it's been that we've had this absolutely gorgeous weather. I think it's perfect weather, but I, for one, am just so looking forward to the rain. It's very dry where I live, and we've been in stage 4 watering restrictions since August the 31st. So, and I also want to say that I'm really happy to feel like I'm not nearly the main attraction today. That honor goes to the people doing Jukai. And I'm really happy that I'm going to be here to see that. It's always a really beautiful and moving ceremony, and I'm really looking forward to learning your new names. So, free congratulations. So before I start on chapter 7, which is the chapter in the Vimalakirti Sutta that I'm going to talk about today, I will recap for those of you who may not have been following the talks on the sutra. Vimalakirti was a layman who was famous for his wisdom, his grasp of the Dharma, and use of expedient means to teach the Dharma. Vimalakirti, according to the sutra, has made it appear that his body has fallen prey to illness. So he is using this illness as a way to teach the Dharma, an example of expedient means. And while many people come to inquire about his illness, he wonders why the Buddha hasn't shown any concern for him. Of course, the Buddha, with his Dharma eye, knows Vimalakirti's thoughts and goes about asking people to come to inquire about, he's asking his various disciples and then the various bodhisattvas to go and inquire about Vimalakirti's illness. And being after being refuses, citing, not feeling competent, as Vimalakirti has always managed to correct them in their views or teachings, maybe even made them feel like dummies. They're totally intimidated by this layperson. Finally, Buddha asked Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, to visit Vimalakirti, who responds that Vimalakirti is very difficult to confront, and goes on to say he is profoundly enlightened in the true nature of reality and skilled at preaching the essentials of the law. In wisdom and expedient means, he has mastered all there is to know. There was more that Manjushri said, but you get the gist. But the encounter with the Buddha ends with Manjushri saying, nevertheless, in obedience to the Buddha's august command, I will go to visit Vimalakirti and inquire about his illness. And in anticipation of the discussion between these two Buddhist illuminati, Vimalakirti and Manjushri, all these living beings are present in this tiny, small room as well. So it's a small room where Vimalakirti is lying ill in his bed. There's bodhisattvas, the Buddha's many disciples, the Brahmas, Indras, heavenly kings, and many heavenly beings. And even though there are hundreds of thousands of beings in this tiny room, it isn't crowded, because this room is boundless, able to hold all beings with ease. So now, chapter 7. The chapter's title is regarding living beings, but an alternate title is the goddess, which will become apparent later in this chapter. It starts with Manjushri asking Vimalakirti, how does the Bodhisattva regard living beings? This is Vimalakirti's answer. As a conjurer looks on the beings he conjures up, thus does the Bodhisattva regard living beings. As a wise view the moon in the water, or a face or form in a mirror, as clouds in the sky, as foam on the water, bubbles in the water, or as clouds in the sky, no longer lasting than a flash of lightning, as the tracks of birds in the sky. Thus does a bodhisattva regard living beings. These are just a few of the examples given in the text. These things are all illusory, not real, insubstantial, impermanent, and empty of self. A couple of other examples given in the sutra are as a child born to a barren woman, as the erection of a eunuch. Not only are these an example of impermanence and emptiness, they are impossible. They cannot exist. Bodhisattvas see beyond the physical form and the egos of living beings and regard them as impermanent, empty, even non-existent. Huh. This leads to the next question. This is Manjushri. If a bodhisattva looked on beings in this way, how can he treat them with compassion? Good question. If a bodhisattva perceives living beings as not real, phantoms, or basically not existing, how indeed can he or she have compassion for them? Vimalakirti's answer. When the bodhisattva has finished regarding them in this way, he thinks to himself, for the sake of living beings, I must preach the law to them. This is true compassion. Initially, I was a little puzzled with this answer, but this is what this passage means to me. It reminds me of our chant, Harmony of Difference and Equality, where relative and absolute are the two sides of the same coin. You can't separate them. Right in light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. Right in darkness, there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark are relative to each other, like the front and back foot in walking. You can't have light without darkness. You can't have darkness without light. Without two legs, there is no walking. In other words, you can't have ultimate truth without relative truth. Here, the bodhisattvas perceive a living being's ultimate reality, their impermanence and emptiness, their insubstantiality. But then at the same time, they also see and appreciate the relative aspects of living beings who are born and suffer. As bodhisattvas, they want to help alleviate the suffering of living beings. That's their vow. And I think that bodhisattvas who are evolved beings full of joy and happiness would also automatically want that for all living beings. They themselves are full of joy and happiness, and they can't help but notice how sad and miserable living beings are. So, want those suffering beings to experience joy and happiness just as they do. Just like if I have a really good recipe for no-bake power balls that I really think is good, I want to share that with other living beings. Now, I'm not a bodhisattva. I just want to share my happiness with others. Kind of like that. There is also teaching in this passage about not getting so hooked by each other. Because if I can appreciate or even remind myself that this being in front of me wants to be happy just like me and is really no different than me, then that separation diminishes. Although we are at times suffering human beings with our neuroses and prickliness, we are also, at our core, Buddha nature. Buddha nature is the fundamental nature of all beings. And if we can regard or perceive the emptiness and impermanence of other people, even a little, maybe we won't get so attached and cling so much, which can be such a problem in relationships. And we can all probably think of a relationship we've been in where the other person, whether it's a parent, a spouse, a lover, or a good friend, has strings attached to their love, certain expectations, or demands, or jealousy. And these relationships are problematic. and can cause a lot of suffering. Manjushri and Vimalakirti continue their questions and answers, but I'm going to skip over some of that to get to my favorite part of the chapter and a famous section of the sutra. So this is from the sutra. At that time, there was a heavenly being, a goddess, in Vimalakirti's room, who, seeing these great men and hearing them expound the law, proceeded to make herself visible, and taking heavenly flowers, scattered them over the bodhisattvas and major disciples. When the flowers touched the bodhisattvas, they all fell to the floor at once. But when they touched the major disciples, they stuck to them and did not fall off. The disciples all tried to shake off the flowers through their supernatural powers, but they could not do so. So the goddess says to Shariputra, who was one of the Buddha's disciples, "Why try to brush off the flowers?" "Such flowers are not in accordance with the law," he replied. "That's why I try to brush them off." And I know most of you have already heard about Shariputra and his role in Mahayana sutras, but it bears repeating. Shariputra was considered to be the Buddha's most eminent disciple and known for his wisdom. He's often mentioned in Mahayana sutras and is often a fall guy in these teachings and represents what was originally called the Hinayana sect of Buddhism, which is all often held up for scrutiny against the Mahayana teachings. Hinayana is translated as lesser vehicle, as opposed to Mahayana, which means greater vehicle. Sounds a little demeaning, doesn't it? Hinayana was termed by the Mahayana practitioners to point out the superiority of their schools of practice, but the term has been largely dropped for obvious reasons. The current term for the early school of Buddhism is Theravada. So, Shariputra is trying to brush the flowers off his robes because one of the many rules of the Vinaya, which were the rules that a monk followed, or still on this day, a Theravada monk follows, was to not wear personal adornments, including flowers. The goddess points out to the venerable Shariputra that the flowers make no distinctions, and it's not true that they are not in accordance with the Dharma. She further points out that Shariputra, with his thinking, has made distinctions, and that is why the flowers are sticking to him. Remember, the flowers immediately fell off the bodhisattvas, but stuck to the Buddha's disciples. The goddess is making the point that Shariputra is still stuck in duality, with ideas of right and wrong, good and bad, etc. Now, Shariputra was an arhat. And by definition, an arhat means he was a fully enlightened being. But according to the goddess and Vimalakirti in the sutra, his enlightenment is incomplete. Because he is still caught in dualistic thinking. Poor Shariputra. He was just trying to follow the rules of the Vinaya and be a conscientious Buddhist monk, and he's getting into trouble for it. I sort of feel sorry for the guy. On the other hand, getting so worked up about some flowers sticking to your robes. It just happens that I'm in a group studying the text inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara, and this is the book here. And I came across a passage very recently that I thought was relevant. At some point, Mahayana Buddhists started to think that the Abhidharmist, which is another term for some of the early Buddhists, they thought that the Abhidharmist had gotten stuck on their investigation of dharmas, stuck on memorizing, categorizing, and believing in their system. Great bodies of Mahayana literature sprang up teaching that dharmas were empty of self-existence. As it says at the beginning of the most widely chanted and celebrated Mahayana text, the Heart Sutra, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, Avalokiteshvara, relieves all suffering by seeing that all dharmas, all phenomena, are empty without their own self-nature. Deep practice in the Mahayana tradition was to see that nothing at all had its own self-nature. So in the early part of the first millennium, there were great debates about whose view or method was correct or most helpful. Now, when Shariputra feels threatened or backed into a corner, he either doesn't answer the question or he changes the subject, and this occurs several times in this interchange with the goddess. Shariputra now changes the subject and asked the goddess how long she had been in this room. She replies, "I have been in this room as long as your attainment of emancipation." But when the goddess specifically asks Shariputra how long he has been enlightened, he is silent and won't answer. The goddess, "With your great wisdom, venerable sir, why do you remain silent?" Shariputra replied, "Emancipation cannot be spoken of in words. Therefore, I do not know what I can say to you." So this is a very provocative thing to say in this situation, as it sounds presumptuous and, again, dualistic. It sounds like Shariputra is giving what we might describe as a zenny answer. But our goddess is having none of it. She is not going to let him get away with it. Goddess, words, writing are all marks of emancipation. Why? Because emancipation is not internal, external, and not in between. And words likewise are not internal, external, and not in between. In other words, she is saying that everything is included. There is nothing left out of the path of liberation or practice. Now, in Shariputra's defense, one could argue that what he says is true, or at least partly true. Isn't awakening something that cannot be described or defined in words or concepts? It's beyond concepts. I suspect that it was also how Shariputra was expressing his answer and demonstrating that he felt that his awakening had nothing to do with the relative world, the world of words and writing. He was telling us that it was something special. As well, our goddess could likely use her powers to see into Shariputra's mind and discern his mind state when he answered that question. Here is a Zen perspective illustrated by case 19 of the Mumon Kan, which is a collection of koans. Joshu asked Nansen, "What is the way?" "Ordinary mind is the way," Nansen replied. "So, nothing special. The way we practice is through our everyday lives and with our ordinary minds. It's nothing exalted, nothing lofty. Our awakening is grounded in and intrinsically linked to this body, this mind." We'll come back to this koan in a bit. There are several other exchanges between the goddess and Shariputra, but I'll skip over them because of time and get to the best part. And this is what happens here. The goddess has just asked Shariputra why, after all the amazing teachings being offered at this house, would anyone take delight in the path of the voice hearer? This is a reference to the disciples of Buddha, who are called voice hearers because they attain enlightenment through hearing the Buddha's talks. And all the amazing teachings refer to those of the Mahayana, given by Vimalakirti and Manjushri in this chapter and the preceding one. It's a bit of a dig at Shariputra again and the Buddha's disciples. Anyway, Shariputra doesn't respond, but changes the subject. Here is the exchange. "Why don't you change out of this female body?" It was a belief at this time, and probably for a long time after, that women could not attain enlightenment. Only men could. And also because she is a goddess, Shariputra seems to think that she would use her magical powers to change her form to a man's. The goddess replied, "For the past 12 years, I have been trying to take on a female form, but in the end, with no success. What is there to change? If a sorcerer were to conjure up a phantom woman and then someone asked her, why didn't she change out of her female body, Would that be any kind of reasonable question? No, said Shariputra. Phantoms have no fixed form, so what would there be to change? The goddess said, all things are just the same. They have no fixed form. So why ask why I don't change out of my female form? The goddess is pointing to our absolute nature beyond the designation of male and female. So now comes the very best part. The goddess uses her magical powers to change Shariputra into her goddess form and transforms herself into Shariputra's form. Can you imagine the shock of Shariputra, who is now in a female body? Horrors. Shariputra, now in the form of a goddess, replied, I don't know why I have suddenly changed and taken on a female body. The goddess said, Shariputra, if you can change out of this female body, then all women can change likewise. Shariputra, who is not a woman, appears in a woman's body. And the same is true of all women. Though they appear in women's bodies, they are not women. Therefore, the Buddha teaches that all phenomena are neither male nor female. This is a great teaching on emptiness. In this case, the emptiness of male and female. We also, at our core, are neither male nor female. This doesn't mean that we aren't men or women in the relative sense, with male and female bodies and attributes, but in the absolute sense or the ultimate truth of us, we are neither male nor female. Isn't that freeing? During the dedication at the end of our service, we dedicate the merit to our ancestors and the two bodhisattvas, Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara. One of the ancestors mentioned is Mahaprajapati. There's an interesting story about her that some of you may know. She was the sister of Maya. Maya, who was the mother of Siddhartha, the future Buddha. Maya died shortly after giving birth to her son. So his aunt, Mahaprajapati, raised him as her own child. Later, when she was widowed, she wanted to ordain as a Buddhist nun and asked permission from the Buddha, her nephew. He initially refused. I won't get into the reason or reasons for this. This is an area of some controversy. But Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, intervened on behalf of Mahaprajapati and the other women with her, and famously asked the Buddha if women could be enlightened, just like men, and the Buddha said, yes. Encountering this particular interchange between the goddess and Shariputra and the teaching in it made me reflect on gender and the expression of it. It's very interesting what is going on in the arena of gender today. There's a growing recognition that not everyone identifies with the gender they were born in. For example, a woman in a female body does not always identify themselves as female or not consistently. The same is true for male-bodied beings. There is a fluidity here that speaks to not being too caught in a particular gender, a loosening of the identification with a particular gender. It helps to reinforce the idea that ultimately what we appear to be in terms of gender and an appearance could be said to be like a mirage. And ultimately, as both the goddess and Buddha tell us, all phenomena are neither male nor female. This includes all of us. The lightening up of our identification with gender is both interesting and in the end, I think, beneficial. There are two signs on both washroom doors in a local coffee shop. It shows a universal sign for male and female, the person in pants and the person in a dress, as well as the depiction of a fish. Then underneath these depictions, it says, whatever, just wash your hands. And though I laughed when I first encountered this sign, On reflection, it seems to me it is a much more evolved way to see this particular issue of gender. Back to the sutra. The goddess changes both of them back to their original bodies and then says to Shariputra, "Where now is the form and shape of your female body?" Shariputra said, "The form and shape of my female body does not exist, yet does not not exist." Now he's sounding like a Zen Buddhist, like one of us. And the goddess ends this interchange with, "All things are just like that. They do not exist, yet do not not exist. And that they do not exist, yet do not not exist, is exactly what the Buddha teaches. I do not exist as a woman in the absolute sense, where all things, phenomena, are empty and impermanent. But in this relative world, I do exist as a woman, or do not not exist as a woman. It's both at the same time, two sides of the same coin." The final exchange between the goddess and Shariputra. This is the goddess. "How long will it be before you attain Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi?" Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi means unsurpassed, complete, and perfect enlightenment, the enlightenment of a Buddha. Shariputra says this to the goddess. The goddess replied, "Shariputra, when you revert to the state of a common enlightened mortal, then I will succeed in gaining complete perfect enlightenment." Shariputra said, "It is unthinkable that I should become a common mortal again." Now remember that Shariputra is Arhat, a fully enlightened being, and by definition, an Arhat cannot be reborn, as he or she has ended the cycle of rebirth and suffering. This is according to the Theravadin tradition. The goddess, "It is likewise unthinkable that I should attain complete perfect enlightenment. Why? Because bodhi, or awakening, is nothing to be thought about, hence nothing to attain." Another teaching in duality. The goddess is saying that bodhi, or awakening, is not conceptual, is nothing we can grasp with our thinking or conceptual mind, and so is not something that we can attain. We talk about Buddha nature, which is what we are at our core, at our very essence. We do not have Buddha nature, we are Buddha nature. But Shariputra goes on to question how Buddhists can attain enlightenment now and have attained enlightenment in the past, and what does the goddess say to that? And she explains that this is just using the function of speech to describe something, enlightenment, that presumably occurs in the relative time frames of past, present, and future, which are also just concepts, not true reality. It's so easy to think awakening or enlightenment as something outside of ourselves and something to get, but it's not that. Awakening is the inherent nature of all beings. Then the goddess said, "Shariputra, have you attained the way of the Arhat?" Shariputra, "I realize that there is nothing to be attained, so I've attained it." The goddess said, "The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are that way too. They've realized there's nothing to attain, and so they've attained it." To go back to that koan, Joshu asked Nansen, "What is the way?" Nansen, "Ordinary mind is the way." Joshu, "Does it go in any particular direction?" Or in other words, "What direction do I go to seek or obtain the way? How do I get there?" Nansen, "The more you seek it, the more it runs away. If we try to find the truth out there, we won't find it because it is not separate from ourselves, our everyday, ordinary selves. We can't seek our Buddha nature because we are Buddha nature. We are so conditioned to run after and get things, whether it's material goods, career advancements, accomplishments, that new car. But to realize true reality, we have to let go of that way of thinking and of running after things. This chapter ends with the host, Vimalakirti, extolling the virtues and supernatural powers of the goddess who is able to show herself at any time she wishes and teach and convert living beings. And I'd like to add, hail to the goddess. You go, girl. Thanks for listening.
Page 3.
May our intentions